Okay, so have you ever been to a protest where things got a little out of hand?
Oh, yeah, I've seen a few.
Like, it gets a little heated, and then all of a sudden you see that one person getting arrested, and you think, wait a minute, how come they're getting arrested and I'm not? Or how come they're getting arrested and nobody else is? You get that feeling of why me or why them. Well, that sense of being singled out, why me, that's at the heart of a Supreme Court case that still matters today. Wait, the United States.
You know, what's so interesting about Waite is that it sets this really high bar for proving what's called selective prosecution, especially when it comes to, our freedom of speech. We're going to be looking at some source material from 1985, back in the Vietnam War era when there was a draft. But the legal stuff, like the principles, are still so relevant.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, think about all the protests happening today.
Totally.
So, to understand how we got to this Waite case, let's rewind back to the early 1980s.
Okay.
President Carter, he had reinstated draft registration. Now, not the draft itself, but the requirement for young men to sign up, right?
Right.
Enter David Waite. This is our main character in all this, in this legal drama. He was very much against the draft. He refused to register. And he even wrote letters to government officials. Like, he really made his views known. Wasn't exactly trying to be quiet about it.
Right. And that's where things get interesting because the government at the time had this policy. They called it passive enforcement. And they weren't like actively going out and finding people who hadn't registered, right? They only prosecuted people who basically turned themselves in, like Waite, or people who got reported by somebody else. So on the surface, it might seem fair, but think about it. If you're like really outspoken against the draft, you're way more likely to get reported, right?
That's true. Yeah, it's true. So it seems like this policy could actually end up targeting the people who are the most vocal, the most opposed, which is basically what Waite argued, right? He's like, hey, I'm being singled out because I'm speaking out against the draft, not just because I didn't register.
Yeah, he argued what we call selective prosecution. You know, that the government was violating his First Amendment rights, that they were basically going after him because of his because of what he believed. Now, you might think, well, that's, kind of an open and shut case. The government's clearly going after people speaking out, but the legal system, well, it's not always that simple.
Yeah, that's where the details get important, right? What happened when Waite's case went to court? Like, was everyone on the same page about this whole passive enforcement thing, whether it was actually discriminatory?
Not really, no. The lower courts actually disagreed about this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so the district court, they actually sided with Waite and dismissed the indictment. But then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, they reversed that decision.
Oh, wow.
So then it goes up to the Supreme Court.
This is where it gets interesting. I mean, the Supreme Court, their decision here would like really impact how we think about selective prosecution and free speech for years to come. So what did they decide?
Well, to put it simply, they sided with the government.
Oh, okay.
Justice Powell wrote the majority opinion, and he set out a kind of two-pronged test.
A two-pronged test. Oh, I love this. Lawyers love a framework. So tell me about these prongs.
Okay, so the first prong, it's all about discriminatory effect. Like, did it disproportionately impact a particular group?
Makes sense.
So in Waite's case, did the passive enforcement thing, did it really hit those who were outspoken against the draft harder than others?
Okay, so it's about the effect, but it can't just be about the effect, right? It has to be like intentional too. What's the second prong?
Exactly, you got it. The second prong, it gets to the government's motive. We call it discriminatory purpose. It means like, did the government actually intend to target people because of what they believed, because of their speech?
So it's not enough to just show that a policy had a bad effect, like it impacted some people more than others. You have to prove they were deliberately, like singling people out for a reason, like their political views. It seems like that would be really hard to prove.
You're telling me, and in Raitt's case, the court said he didn't meet either of those prongs.
Oh, wow.
They said the policy was like technically applied to everyone who got reported, whether they'd spoken out against the draft or not. But here's the catch.
Come on, though. If they were only going after people who were reported, wouldn't that like automatically make it unfair? I mean, the people who just kept quiet about it, they were less likely to get in trouble even if they also hadn't registered.
That's a great point, and that's exactly where Justice Marshall's dissent comes in. Like, he really disagreed with the majority opinion.
So Justice Marshall wasn't buying it, huh? What was his argument?
Well, the majority basically said, okay, we believe the government when they say they weren't targeting anyone for their speech, but Justice Marshall was like, whoa, hold on a second, there's a big problem here. Waite's lawyers, they wanted to see the government's files, like internal memos, things like that. They wanted to see if there was any proof that the government was intentionally targeting people who were speaking out against the draft, but the court said no.
So they wanted to see if the government was like, show your work, basically. But the court said, nope, you can't see behind the curtain. isn't that a little, I don't know, suspicious?
Yeah.
Like, how do you prove that there's bad intent if you can't even see if there's evidence?
That's what Justice Marshall said. He said that denying Wade access to those documents was basically rigging the game against him.
Yeah.
Like, how can he prove they were targeting him based on his beliefs if he can't even see the evidence?
Right. It doesn't seem very fair. It makes you wonder about, you know, transparency in the legal system. I mean, if the government could just say, trust us, we're not targeting anyone, without having to show anything to prove it, that's a lot of power, right?
It is, absolutely. And that's what makes Justice Marshall's dissent so powerful, I think. He saw that power imbalance. Like, the government has all this information, but the individual, they're left struggling to prove their case.
It's true. I mean, how many times do you think this has happened where somebody was really unfairly targeted but couldn't do anything about it because they couldn't access the evidence? Makes you think.
It does, and it highlights, like, this tension in our system. On the one hand, we have the First Amendment, you know, protecting free speech. But then we have cases like this where it's so hard to actually prove when that freedom has been violated.
Yeah, that's kind of a scary thought. This whole Wade case, it's not just about draft resistance, though, is it? I mean, think about what's happening today with all these protests.
Exactly.
If somebody gets arrested at a protest and they feel like they were singled out because of their views, this case makes it, like, super hard to prove that, right?
Absolutely. And it goes beyond protests, too. Think about whistleblowers, people who try to expose what's going on in the government, or people who are targeted for stuff they say online, you know, activism and stuff. This case basically set a precedent that makes it really tough to prove you were targeted for your beliefs and not just for what you did.
So they could, like, get away with targeting people for their views as long as they can make it look neutral on the surface. It doesn't feel right.
It's a tough situation for sure, but the Wade case isn't a complete dead end.
Okay.
Justice Marshall, his dissent, it reminds us that fairness in the process, that's so important. Like, the right to see the evidence, that's crucial. That's a cornerstone of our whole legal system.
So what does that mean for people, like, practically speaking? If somebody thinks they're being targeted unfairly, what can they do? It's not like everyone can take their case to the Supreme Court.
Well, not every case goes that far, but what we learn from Wade is that documentation is so important. You know, keep records of everything.
Got it.
And find good legal help, someone who knows this stuff inside and out. And honestly, be ready for a fight. It could be a long one. This case also shows us that we need more transparency from the government, and maybe we need to rethink how we prove selective prosecution. Like, are those standards really fair?
So document everything, lawyer up, and be ready for a battle. Not exactly comforting, but definitely important advice.
It is. It's about giving people the knowledge they need to protect themselves, and it's about remembering that these dissenting opinions, like Justice Marshall's, they matter. They might not always win, but they keep these important discussions going.
That's true. It also reminds us that the law is always changing, right? Like, even something that seems settled can be reinterpreted, challenged. So speaking of reinterpretation, I'm curious, what's happened since the Wade case? Has there been anything, you know, since the 80s? Has Wade been reinterpreted or challenged in any big ways?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the answer is it's kind of messy.
Okay.
The main things from Wade, that two-pronged test, is still really important.
Right.
But how those principles are actually used, the kind of evidence that matters, that's where things get interesting.
Got it. So how about some examples? Like, how have later cases dealt with Wade?
Okay, well, think about prosecutorial discretion.
Okay.
Prosecutors have a lot of power. They decide who to charge, what the charges are. Wade kind of gave them a lot of freedom, you know?
Right.
Made it hard to challenge their decisions, even if there were signs of bias. But some later cases have tried to limit that discretion a bit.
Oh, okay.
They acknowledge that there's potential for abuse, especially with policies that seem neutral but actually have, you know, discriminatory effects.
So it's like, looking deeper at the context, the patterns, even if proving intent is still really difficult. It sounds like this whole area of selective prosecution, it's evolving.
It is, yeah. And Wade is still a big part of that. It makes us think about fairness, equality, the power dynamics between the government and individuals.
So big picture, what's the takeaway here? What should our listeners, especially those in the legal field, be thinking about after this deep dive?
I think Wade shows us just how complex our legal system really is.
Yeah.
It reminds us that these old cases, even from way back, they still influence how we deal with free speech, government accountability, you know, all of it.
And it shows that the law isn't always a clear path to justice. Like, it can be used to protect people or to hurt them, depending on who's using it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's so important for lawyers, judges, anyone who cares about justice to really know these cases, to understand them.
Right, to be ready to challenge them when they need to.
Yeah, to push for more transparency, to stand up for people who are vulnerable, to make sure the law actually does what it's supposed to do, protect everyone's rights, not just the powerful.
Well said. So as we wrap up this deep dive, the message is stay informed, keep asking questions. The fight for justice never really ends. And understanding cases like Waite gives us the tools to, you know, fight for a fairer world.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. Until next time, keep learning and keep exploring.